Thank you, Ken. May the Lord add His blessing to the reading of His Word. You have just heard Job chapter 1, verses 20 through 22. You know, friends, we live in an imperfect world. As Christians, we recognize that this imperfection stems from the fall of Adam in the Garden of Eden. Thus, we are also imperfect people living in an imperfect world with other imperfect people. If this were a perfect world, then we'd have no financial problems, no leaky roofs, no difficulties in marriage, no flat tires. There'd be no bee stings. There would be no pain in childbirth. We'd never cut ourselves shaving. We need not have to weed our gardens. There'd be no runs in our hose. Not my hose, but you ladies know the program. No lippy kids, no sickness, no death, and so on and so forth. But because the world is imperfect, we must endure imperfection and all the pain and the suffering that goes along with it. Now, friends, there are two kinds of evil, two kinds of pain and suffering, as it were. First of all, there's moral evil. That is, disobeying God's law. For example, thou shalt not kill. If you commit murder, then you are performing a moral evil. Adam's evil in the garden was disobeying God. He went against God's law. He went against God's directions. So there's moral evil, but there's also non-moral evil. Non-moral evil are things like natural catastrophes and disease, tornadoes and smallpox. Those are non-moral evil. You know, you're not a bad person for being hit by a tornado. It doesn't mean that you're evil, but that's an evil that takes place in God's natural world. Well, Adam's moral evil is what brought both kinds of evil into our world. The reason there's moral evil in the world and the reason there's non-moral evil in the world is because when Adam and Eve fell in the Garden of Eden, God cursed the ground and cursed creation for Adam's sake. So Adam's moral evil brought moral and non-moral evil into the world. Still, though the fall of Adam and Eve helps us understand where the suffering and hardship are rooted, some insist that that doesn't explain everything. Why is there so much suffering in this world? Why do the seemingly innocent suffer? Why do good people suffer? We've been discussing God's decrees over the past couple of weeks. And I pointed out that everything that happens, even that which is evil in the world, somehow happens according to God's plans and purposes. God ordains all events. Remember, we looked at Proverbs 16:33. The lot is cast into the lap. Even when dice are cast, it's every decision is from the Lord. Even when you're playing Yahtzee, even when some guy thinks he's getting lucky out in Las Vegas and he's shooting craps, whatever comes up is because God has ordained it in one way or another. God has decreed all things. And that includes human suffering, hardship, and the evils that beset us. Of course, those who reject biblical revelation deny that and say that the existence of evil and a suffering, existence of suffering calls into question the existence of God, or at least limits Him in power or in mercy or in compassion. For example, atheists and skeptics follow the lead of 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume. And they claim that there is a conflict between God's goodness, God's power, and the existence of evil. If God is all good, and if He's all powerful, then why does evil exist? If He were all good, He'd want to eliminate evil. If God were all powerful, He'd be able to eliminate evil. Therefore, since evil exists, He's either not all good, or He's not all powerful. Now, friends, of course, such criticisms leave the atheist open to some valid counterpoints. First of all, if an atheist admits the existence of evil, then he also assumes the existence of good. Where does good come from? If evil serves as evidence against God's existence, doesn't good serve as evidence to prove God's existence? Second, what criteria does the atheist use to distinguish between good and evil? You see, an atheist must turn to naturalism for his worldview. If there is no God, then the only thing that exists is nature. The things that we see surrounding us. There is merely physics. There is merely a matter. The stuff that makes up the universe. But if the atheist assumes the universe exists by way of blind, amoral, impersonal chance forces, Where does he get his moral consciousness? How does he know right from wrong? Because blind, amoral chance forces do not create morals. In a naturalistic universe, all ideas, even our consciousness itself, is reduced to biology and chemistry. Biology and chemistry don't tell you what's right and wrong. There is then no objective standard for right and wrong or good and evil. Indeed, good and evil really have no meaning. If naturalism were true, good and evil don't exist. Only events exist. I have here a quote that I'd like to read to you from a book by Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins is a very famous contemporary atheist. And he wrote in his book, River Out of Eden, and this is fairly lengthy, it'll take me a couple minutes here, but it says, "Theologians worry away at the problem of evil and a related problem of suffering. On the day I originally wrote this paragraph, the British newspapers all carried a terrible story about a bus full of children from a Roman Catholic school that crashed for no obvious reason with wholesale loss of life. Not for the first time, clerics were in paroxysms over the theological question that a writer on a London newspaper framed this way, quote, 'How can you believe in a loving, all-powerful God who allows such a tragedy?' The article went on to quote one priest's reply, quote, 'The simple answer is that we do not know why there should be a God who lets these awful things happen, but the horror of the crash to a Christian confirms the fact that we live in a world of real values, positive and negative. If the universe was just electrons, there would be no problem of evil or suffering,' which is exactly what I just said. If the world is merely naturalism, if all there is physics and biology and chemistry, then there is no evil or good. Well, here's what Richard Dawkins says in reply to this priest. 'On the contrary, if the universe were just electrons and selfish genes, meaningless tragedies like the crashing of this bus are exactly what we should expect, along with equally meaningless good fortune.'" Now it's interesting, he frames this, he says, "on the contrary," and then he merely repeats what the priest said. The priest said, there's a problem of evil if God exists, but if there is no God, then we have no problem of evil. Then he says, "on the contrary, if there is no God and all there is electrons, we would expect this to happen, that there's meaningless events." He only repeated what the priest said, but made it look like he's disagreeing with it. "Such a universe would be neither evil nor good in intention. It would manifest no intentions of any kind. In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. As that unhappy poet A.E. Housman put it, 'For nature, heartless, witless nature, will neither know nor care.'" Then here's how Dawkins finishes his chapter. "DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music." Biology is all there is, and we dance to its music. Physics is all there is, and we dance to its music. Chemistry is all there is, and we dance to its music. Why then do people like Richard Dawkins then turn around and use the existence of evil and the existence of suffering to try to disprove the existence of God? When he says right there that if there is no God, then there's no meaning to these things. There is no good or evil. What then is their point of argumentation? So you see here, if what Dawkins says is true, then the question of evil is moot. Without God, we have no value system to determine good and evil, so the atheist's arguments against God's existence really carry no weight. Now these arguments are handy in refuting atheist claims concerning evil and God's power and His existence, but we still haven't addressed the why of evil. Evil does exist. And since it does, we must explain how it fits into a universe ruled by a good and all-powerful God. Not only that, we must deal with it when we experience pain and hardship. That's where the rubber really meets the road. You know, we can think of evil in the abstract, but sometimes it's not only abstract, it's also very real in our lives. Why do bad things happen to me? Is there a positive side to evil? Well, let's look at some ways in which suffering and evil can have a positive sanctifying effect in our lives. In God's decree, in God's providential care, as He's working all things out for His glory to the end result of His kingdom, how does evil fit in with all of that? Well, first of all, I want you to note that suffering tests our faith. Suffering tests our faith. Evil tests our faith. Now, we've already noted this to a degree over the past couple of Sundays, but I want to put a little more flesh on the bones here and fill in a few more gaps. We've talked in the past about how this forces us to trust God. We just talked about that last week. Let's talk a little bit more about that today. Perhaps you've heard of Rabbi Harold Kushner. Rabbi Kushner had a son who died of progeria. Progeria is that rapid aging disease, so you can have a 9 or 10 year old child that might die as an 80 year old man because genetically they just have rapid aging. They lose their hair, their bones become brittle, and they die of old age when they're just very small and young children. Well, anyway, in response to this tragedy in his own life, he wrote a book entitled When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And the conclusion that he came to in his book is that God is imperfect, and we should forgive Him for not making a better world. Though he doesn't reject God altogether, Kushner buys into a form of David Hume's argument. Suffering in the world demonstrates that an all-good, all-powerful God does not exist. He wasn't good enough or powerful enough to make a flawless world. Now, though we can sympathize with Rabbi Kushner, having lost his son, he took the opposite tack that he should have. Instead of questioning God's power or wisdom and creating a flawed God, he should have grabbed hold of and trusted the God of Scriptures who shows himself as all good and all powerful. And Job sets the example for us. That brings us to our text here. Let's quickly rehash the story. You know the story of Job. Job was a righteous man. He performed sacrifices even on behalf of his children because they may have sinned and not even realized it. So I want to cover all the bases, even for my children. He's a righteous man. He eschews evil. He rejects evil. He repudiates evil. He's a good man. And as you go through the book, you find out that he gave to the poor. He cared about the widows and the orphans. He was a man of integrity and of honesty. Well, anyway, there comes a day in which Satan presents himself to God. And God says, "Have you noticed my servant Job down there? How he's a man of integrity who loves me." And Satan says, "Yeah, but you know, it's only because you've blessed him so much that he worships you. If you take away what he has, if you destroy him, he'll curse you to your face." And God says, "Okay." He says, "I'll take that bet, as it were, in a sanctified way." He says, "You go ahead and have at him, but you can't touch his body. You can't do anything to him personally." Well, anyway, you know the story. Satan goes down, he takes away Job's children, he takes away Job's flocks, he takes away Job's herds, and leaves him absolutely without wealth whatsoever. And then we come to the text that we just read a little bit ago that was read for us to start, that Ken read. Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, he fell down to the ground and worshipped. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return." In other words, I came into this life with nothing, and when I leave this life, I'm going out with nothing. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. So God then says, "Satan, have at him." Satan does so. Job says, "Look what God has done to me. I've lost everything, but I'm not going to turn my back on God." Then we find a second episode. Satan comes back. God says, "Hey, Satan, did you notice down there that when you touched Job's body and when all of this stuff happened to him, he maintained his integrity, though you forced me or though you challenged me to raise my hand against him?" Satan says, "Skin for skin, yea, all that a man hath will he give for his life. Touch his body and he'll curse you to your face." God says, "Okay, you can touch his body, but you can't kill him." So he goes down, covers Job's body from head to toe with sore, oozing boils. And then we find in chapter 2, verse 10, actually verse 9, his wife comes to him. You know, it's kind of a disgusting scene. He's covered with sore boils. He takes a potsherd to scrape himself while he's sitting among the ashes. And then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. He still maintains his trust. Now, Job never really gets an answer to why this happened to him. God doesn't answer his questions. But even though he doesn't understand everything that's taking place here, he doesn't understand all the whys, the wherefores, and so forth, he remains firm in his faith. He trusts God, though he's lost everything but his very life. God has taken Job to the place where all he has is God himself. And having been taken to that point, his innermost beliefs, his fundamental convictions become clear and they remain strong. You know, suffering is sort of like being at the fork of a road. While you're there, you have to make a choice. You can curse God to his face as Satan said Job would do, or we can say verse 21, "Naked came I from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Those are our two choices. We can curse God and die, as Job 2:9 says, or we can take the tack of verse 10. Shall we receive good at the hand of God, not receive adversity, not receive evil? We can reject God altogether, or we can water him down to where he's nothing more than a well-meaning but mistake-prone cheerleader. Or we can say with Job in chapter 23, verse 10, "But he knows the way I take. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold." Those are our choices. And we find this sort of thing happening in other places in Scripture, don't we? Look at Genesis chapter 22, verses 11 and 12, for example. Remember, God says, "Okay, now Isaac, or Abraham, I've given you Isaac, your beloved son, the promised son. Now I want you to take him and kill him." He's his only beloved son. He is the promised son, the one through whom the covenant is going to be fulfilled. He's the one that God promised him for years and years and years, and now he's merely, you know, maybe 12, 13, 14 years old. He says, "I want you to take him to a place I'm going to show you, and I want you to sacrifice him to me as a human sacrifice." Abraham does it. He takes Isaac along. Isaac apparently goes willingly. So they both show great faith in this account as far as I'm concerned. But when Abraham raises the knife to slay Isaac, God stops him and he says, "Now I know that you love me because you didn't even withhold your only son from me." See, God put him in a place where he had to choose. Do I love my son more than I love God? And he passed the test. Do you trust me to keep my promise of a nation like stars for the multitude and like the sand of the sea for the multitude? Do you bank on me, and do you trust me to keep that promise despite the fact I'm asking you to kill my son? The book of Hebrews chapter 11 answers that question and says that Abraham understood and knew that God would raise him from the dead if he killed him. So Abraham passed the test. Philippians chapter 4, verses 10 through 13. A slightly different story, but fundamentally I think it's the same sort of an issue where the Apostle Paul thanks the Philippian church and he says, "Thank you for the monetary gift that you gave me." He says, "Not that I necessarily demand it or need it." He says, "Because I have learned that whatever circumstances I'm in, I've learned to get along just fine. I can be in want or I can be in prosperity. I've known both, and I know the Lord's going to take care of me in all circumstances because I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." So no matter how bad things get or no matter how good things get, I trust Him regardless because He's going to take care of me. Habakkuk 3:17 through 19, the book of Habakkuk is an interesting book because Habakkuk is a righteous man and he's looking over his sinful nation, the nation of Judah, and he says, "Lord, we're sinful people. Why aren't you correcting us? Why aren't you doing something to fix the spiritual and moral problems that we have here in our nation?" God says, "I am going to fix it. I'm going to send the Babylonians. I'm going to send them, and they're going to punish you, and that's how I'm going to judge you for your sin, the nation of Judah." Habakkuk says, "Now wait a minute. That's not fair. We're bad, but they're worse. Is it right to use a more evil people to judge those who are less evil than they?" Again, Habakkuk doesn't get an answer. God essentially says, "You have to trust me." And then at the end of the book, in chapter 3, verses 17 through 19, Habakkuk, after thinking this through, he says, "Although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall fruit be in the vines, the labor of the olive shall fail, and the field shall yield no food, the flock will be cut off from the fold, and there will be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. He will make my feet to be like hinds' feet, and He will make me to walk upon mine high places." In other words, no matter how bad things get, no matter if I am poverty-stricken and have nothing left on this earth, I still trust Him and I still love Him. And He'll bring me around eventually according to His timetable. "I love You, Lord," Habakkuk says, "and no matter what happens or how bad things get, I won't give up though all the hounds of hell would bark against me." As I've told you many times, friends, we often think that faith is getting what we want from God. "Oh, let's go to so-and-so. He's got great faith. He'll pray and you'll get a job. Oh, he's got great faith and we'll pray and your loved one will be healed." And there's nothing wrong with it. That is, in a sense, that is part of what faith is. We trust God to do good things for us. We trust God to provide for us. We trust God that He will heal, that God will somehow or another bring good out of tragedy. We trust Him for all these things. But you know, friends, faith is not simply getting what we want from God. Job and Habakkuk and Paul and Abraham and a variety of others, even Jesus Himself, they all show us that faith is accepting what you get from God and loving Him anyway. This is the kind of faith and trust trials and suffering bring out in God's people. You see, the Lord wants us to love Him for reasons other than for the things that He gives us. And if He so tested Job and Paul and others, don't you think He'll test you too? Here's a story about a young man who was in college and he had to have a science class in order for him to graduate. So he took a class on birds, an ornithology class, and he didn't think that sounded too exciting, but he had to take something. It was the only thing that fit into his schedule. So he took this class on ornithology. He was bored stiff for 16 weeks throughout the entire semester. Well, it got down to the end of the semester, and they only had the one exam. It was the final exam. And after he was bored to tears through 16 weeks, he gets this exam, and all it is a bunch of pictures of birds' legs and feet. That's all it is. Page after page of birds' feet. And the instructions were, identify what birds these are by just looking at their feet. He looked at that test and said, this is ridiculous. So he looks, he doesn't even put his name on it. He just stands up, he goes up to the professor's desk and he throws the test down. And he says, this is the stupidest test that I've ever taken. This is the stupidest class I've ever had. You're the stupidest professor I've ever had. This test is ridiculous and I'm not taking it. And he says, well, young man, I'm afraid you're going to flunk. And he says, fine, flunk me. Well, the professor looks at the thing and he says, well, listen, he says, you didn't put your name on it. Who should I give this F to? So the young man lifted his pant leg and says, you tell me who I am. Friends, some tests are hard. And you know, the ones the Lord gives are the hardest of all. But if we truly love Him, we'll pass those tests. Just like Job did. Just like Habakkuk did. Just like Paul did. Just like Jesus did. Second, I want you to note that suffering is a means of correction. I can still tell you about the corners in the house of when I grew up. I know them all by heart. No. This is in Hebrews chapter 12. Why don't you turn there? Hebrews chapter 12, verses 5 through 11. A couple of boys, teenage boys, were caught stealing apples from a local market. So the father wouldn't let them go to the ball game. They had their hearts setting on going to a major league game. They were going to get in the car and take the day and go to see the major league game. And boys, they just had their hearts set on them. And the father said, no, you're not going to go for punishment. You're going to pick sweet corn all day long. Well, these boys get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and the father makes them pick this sweet corn. And they pick all day long and middle of the afternoon, the hot sun, a neighbor comes over and says, now why don't you let those boys go to the ball game? Why didn't you let them go? I mean, you could have picked sweet corn any time. Your punishment's too harsh. And the father said, I'm not picking sweet corn. I'm raising boys. Brother, when it comes to us, God is raising boys and girls. And the trials He sends our way develop our character and strengthen our faith. Look at our text. Let's turn over again, like I said, to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12, in context, we find that the apostle, whoever it is that wrote it, I almost said the apostle Paul, we're not sure who wrote the book of Hebrews. But the book of Hebrews chapter 12 starts out saying that Jesus has given His all for us. He suffered and endured His suffering. And now, you know, He's seated at the right hand of God because He saw the joy and the glory that was His. So He endured it. And also, you're going through hardship and trial, so don't give up. And then He goes on to write these words. And I don't have time to give a whole lot of explanation of this text because the overall idea is very clear. You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. In other words, yeah, you're being persecuted, but you haven't been killed yet. It's bad enough, but you haven't been put to death. And you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. Now, this is a quote from Proverbs 3:11 and 12. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by Him. For those whom the Lord loves, He disciplines, and He scourges every son whom He receives. Don't get upset when God disciplines you. Don't get upset when God gives you a timeout or spanks you or puts you in the corner. Don't get upset when that happens. For those whom He loves, He disciplines. And He scourges every son whom He receives. The word discipline means to instruct or to chasten or to direct with a view to educating. And there's no good way, friends, of explaining what the word scourge means. It means to whip or to flog. God chastens us. Why? He disciplines us and scourges us. It is for discipline that you endure. In other words, God is disciplining you and you're enduring these things because He wants you to learn from it. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Now, friends, that's kind of harsh language for our day and age, perhaps. But God's chastening proves that we belong to Him. If we aren't disciplined, we're illegitimate. Now, illegitimate children, back in this day and age, you have to put this sort of in their context. Because back in this day and age, a child born out of wedlock, perhaps to a slave or to a concubine, the father couldn't have cared less about it. Of course, that's bad enough that happens in this day and age as well, at often times. But the point that he's making is look, if a child is illegitimate, the father has no part with him. He doesn't give him any part of the inheritance. He doesn't love the child. He doesn't discipline the child. He just abandons the child. He doesn't care what that slave girl's kid is all about. Such children were generally ignored by the father and were not considered heirs. So if we're not chastened by God, then we're not His. We're not His heirs. On the other hand, God chastens and reproves us, which is proof that we are His, that He loves us, and that we're heirs of God to receive His glory. But there's more. Verse 9. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? We respect our earthly fathers for chastening us. How much more should we respect God's chastening and find life? Well, how does subjection to God's chastening bring us life? Well, verses 10 and 11 answer that. For they disciplined us for a short time, as seemed best to them, but He, that is God, disciplines us for our good, so that we may share His holiness. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. In other words, human fathers chasten us as they saw fit. But of course, all human fathers are fallible and imperfect. Sometimes we make mistakes. Sometimes the punishment's too harsh. Sometimes it's not harsh enough. Sometimes we're weak. Sometimes we're too overbearing, or whatever the case might be. But we make mistakes at times. We're imperfect. But God, on the other hand, who's perfect in all things that He does, He disciplines us to make us holy, to make us righteous. He's doing it to develop our character. We might not like it, but again, God's not picking corn. He's raising boys. In the Old Testament, so often, God used discipline to correct His people. It didn't always bring the repentance that God intended, but God often did it. Here's a classic example from Amos chapter 4. Starting with verse 8, and it's this context, this is only part of the context. But I gave you also cleanness of teeth in all your cities, and lack of bread in all your places. In other words, God says, I sent famine. Yet you have not returned to me, declares the Lord. Furthermore, I withheld the rain from you while there were still 3 months until harvest. Then I would send rain on one city, on another city I would not send rain. One part would be rained on while the part not rained on would dry up. So two or three cities would stagger to another city to drink water, but you would not be satisfied. Yet you have not returned to me, declares the Lord. And he goes on and on with a couple of other illustrations of things that I have done in order to get you to come around, to instruct you, to bring about your faith, to increase your holiness, but you would not listen to me. Do you remember envying the undisciplined kid when you were growing up? There's always one kid in your circle of friends or in your neighborhood or whatever, or in your school, that got to do whatever he wanted to do. He stayed up all night. He'd always come into school saying how he stayed up till after midnight and he watched cartoons or whatever the case might be, and how he got to ride his bike all over town, do whatever he wanted to do. And they never seemed to have any discipline. Had all sorts of freedom. Boy, we thought, man, I sure would like to be able to take my bike wherever I wanted to go. I sure would like to be able to do this, that, and the other thing. And I sure would like to stay up all night. We didn't stop to think that usually that kid had the worst grades in class. And also, we didn't think at the time when you're 8 or 9 or 10 years old where that kid's going to wind up someday. Where do kids like that usually wind up? Well, sometimes jail. Not always, but sometimes. Or they become shiftless, ne'er-do-wells, they're careless, they're irresponsible. Again, not always. But generally speaking, as a rule of thumb, the less discipline, the less care, the less direction that a child gets, the more directionless and the more careless they're going to be once they grow up. That's why our parents disciplined us as children. So that when we grew into adults, we'd be adults of character, responsibility, and values. Well, God disciplines us for the same reason. He wants to mold us into people of solid Christian character, that we might escape the pitfalls of this life, and that we might escape the wrath to come, and that we might enter His kingdom with joy. You know, doctors set bones when they break. It hurts when the doctor sets a bone. It's painful when the doctor sets a bone, but it's good for us, isn't it? God does this to us spiritually. Just like a doctor sets a physical bone and makes it hurt in order to correct it, so also the pains and the hardships that we endure that God sends our way, His discipline is unpleasant. But those things have a remedial and a sanctifying effect, purifying us that we might be healthy and fit for His kingdom. Finally, I want you to note that suffering strengthens us. Suffering strengthens us. In the book of James, chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, we read these words. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect results so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Do you ever go to a garage sale? How many times have you been to garage sales and you have found a lot of exercise equipment for sale? People, you know, I bought this $1,000 treadmill, I went out and bought this $1,000 stair stepper, and now I'm selling it for $50. Why do they have so much exercise equipment for sale? Well, some people, they do so because they found out they just didn't have enough time to put as much regular effort into it as they wanted to. But you know, a lot of people, they put that stuff out on the garage sale because, man, it hurts to get back in shape. I was sore for a couple of days when I got on that treadmill. They were deterred by how difficult it becomes. They get tired, they get sore, and it isn't long until they lose their motivation. The problem is, if they'd have just kept it up for a week, it's about that long when you start noticing a difference. Hey, I'm getting stronger at this. Hey, I've lost a few pounds. Hey, my muscles aren't as sore. Hey, I'm more flexible. Using that stuff regularly is what brings improvement in your health and in your physical condition. If they would have just kept it up, their strength and endurance would have increased. But they gave up too soon. Well, friends, Christian suffering is like that. It causes discomfort. But as we endure it, we become more strong spiritually. James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4 bring that out exactly. Consider it joy. Hey, this is a great thing, actually, when you look at it from the right perspective. When you encounter trials, God is producing endurance in you. You're becoming more, you have more of a stick-to-itiveness. You have more of a staying power when you have to endure, when you're forced to go that extra mile. God is strengthening you. And that endurance will have its perfect result so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. God is sanctifying us throughout this life, and the day is coming in which we will be perfect and complete. It won't happen in this life, but God is maturing us and sanctifying us through the endurance and through the trials that we must bear. He's making us stronger so that we enter the kingdom will be complete. You know, athletes, weightlifters, runners, whatever the case might be, they have to put up with and go through a lot of hard work and exertion. But that creates strength and endurance. And in the same way, God tests our faith. The trials we go through are like God adding weight to the bar. You know, God says, okay, I see that you can lift 50 pounds over your head. Let's add 2 pounds to that. Let's see what happens when we add the 2 pounds. Okay, now that you can handle 52 pounds, let's add 10 more pounds. Let's add another pound. Let's add 15 more pounds or whatever. And He's building us up and building us up, making us stronger and stronger. He's adding a little distance to the run to give our hearts just a little bit better workout, to give our lungs a little bit better workout, helping us to become more holy, more mature, and more capable of handling the next trial that comes our way without failing or giving up. Too many people will fail and they put their faith in the garage sale. They don't want it anymore. Because after all, it hurts to be a Christian. And that's one of the disservices we often find within Christianity. Hey, come to Jesus, all your problems are solved. Hey, it's so great to be a Christian, won't be any problems anymore. You'll be able to, you know, you'll be rich like me. You'll be driving an Audi or, you know, a Lexus or something like that. Everything will work out just fine. And when things don't, people are disillusioned. When the Scriptures say, put on the whole armor of God, because while you're saved, the battle's just begun. General George Patton was once upset with a subordinate officer. So on the eve of an important battle, General Patton wrote this in his personal papers. I believe that he, the officer, is a coward. Therefore, I have ordered him to ride in the lead attack vehicle tomorrow. This will make him either a corpse or a man. After the battle, and the officer survived, General Patton wrote in his papers, I feel I can now put full confidence in this officer. See, it was the trial that he went through that then proved him. So now he's a good soldier. And likewise, Christian suffering stretches us so that we're better than what we were before, so that we'll be good soldiers of the Lord Jesus Christ. God doesn't want to destroy you or trifle with you or torment you in your trials. In love, He seeks to strengthen you and to steel you and to empower you. Suffering in the Christian life has a positive result then. Like General Patton made his officer into a good soldier, so also God makes us into good soldiers. As the old hymn, How Firm a Foundation, says, when through fiery trials thy pathway shall lie, my grace all sufficient shall be thy supply. The flame shall not hurt thee, I only design thy dross to consume and thy gold to refine. Turn your hymn books, please.